Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we go up in the air for an aerial view of Kern County's Cimarrick oil field. And on the ground in Tulare County, will a village of tiny homes help solve the homeless crisis? I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. You may know McFarland for the Disney movie about an underdog cross-country track team winning the state championship. But now, the town is in the spotlight for a different reason. Two investigative reporters tell us about its Second Chance Police Department.
And in the news, Bernie Sanders is in Fresno today to kick off another 2020 campaign tour of California. His rally at Fresno City College touts the Green New Deal, a congressional resolution to reduce fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions and transition the economy to largely support clean energy industries.
The Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments this week in the case brought by the Trump administration to end DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. DACA gives people brought to the U.S. as children work permits and protection from deportation. At a rally in Fresno Tuesday, America Hernandez said her parents brought her to the U.S. when she was just 3 months old. She supports DACA because it gives her legal status.
I have done everything I'm supposed to. I pay my taxes. I'm a homeowner. I am a part of a philanthropic movement that contributes back to the community.
The Armenian American community in the Valley is disappointed over comments Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said during a press conference with President Trump this week. Erdogan denied the Armenian genocide and berated the House of Representatives for voting last month to commemorate it. Here's Berj Apkarian, Fresno's honorary consul to the Republic of Armenia.
Definitely we're upset because the denial continues. Am I surprised? No, absolutely not, because the current government is even more aggressive in terms of using lobbyists in Washington and continue the strategy of denial.
And late last week, another oil seep was reported in Kern County's Cimarrick oil field. In July, we told you about an oil seep there that brought 1.3 million gallons of oily water to the surface. It prompted violations, fines, and investigations into state regulators. But it's still only half of what seeped to the surface this year in total, just in this oil field. FM89's Carrie Klein takes us to Bakersfield, where she gets a bird's eye view of the incidents.
Juan Flores is a community organizer with the advocacy group Center for Race, Poverty, and the Environment. He remembers being in a meeting in July when his phone started blowing up.
A fellow colleague in the environmental justice work, he literally called me three times.
At first, he declined the calls.
And by the third time, I said, no, this is something important and serious, you know, so let me actually step out and take the call.
The colleague was telling him about an oil seep, what the state calls a surface expression. Dubbed the 1Y expression, a dry stream bed had filled with oil and water in the Cimarrick oil field. It's west of Bakersfield, near the unincorporated community of McKittrick.
What he told me next was, and it has probably been going for months, and we didn't know.
It had been going on for 2 months. And in August, another seep happened in the same oil field, then another in September. Since July, at least a half dozen surface expressions have been reported, totaling more than 2 million gallons of oil, water, and mud. That's around four Olympic-sized swimming pools.
It just became clear, you know, the problem is bigger, and we really have to go out there, and we really have to find out what's going on.
These surface expressions only became illegal in April, but that doesn't mean the public knows about all of them or how close they are to communities. That's why, on a Saturday morning, Flores and a few others meet at a small terminal at Meadows Field Airport.
That step right there, and watch your head.
They hop into a tiny single-engine Cessna that feels more cramped than a two-door sports car.
You have enough room?
Right now, I do.
The flight's sponsored by a handful of environmental groups, and the goal is to provide a 1,000-foot view of the oil field. Soon, we're rumbling through the hazy skies, chattering in noise-canceling headsets.
So here's the town of McKittrick.
Pretty tiny.
Rolling, sunburnt hills full of well pads and derricks extend in every direction. In 2017, Kern County produced more than 70% the state's oil and gas. That same year, a report estimated the industry provided 21,000 jobs and $2.9 billion in income.
Right on, guys. So we're going to start headed west towards the Simrick oil field.
We venture first to the 1Y site, that first SEAP reported in July. The state originally claimed the SEAP posed no danger, but it later reversed that claim after four birds were oiled and died.
Is this what they're cleaning up right here?
The state reports the site has been cleaned up. Chevron operates this and most other sites where SEAPs occurred, and the company maintains there was never a risk to people.
This part they cleaned up, right below us to the right.
Excellent.
The cause of these SEAPs is still unknown. The state oil and gas regulator, known as Dogger, is investigating whether they're related to a process known as cyclic steam injection. It involves forcing high-pressure steam underground to heat the oil and push it toward a wellhead. It's widely used around the state, mostly without problems. But in 2011, an oil worker died after falling into a sinkhole where oil injected with steam had unexpectedly risen to the surface. From the air, we can also see a concrete structure where Chevron is cleaning up a different surface expression. This one's flowed off and on for 16 years.
They're still pumping oil from 2003, lower right, just ahead. See the blue tank.
In that time, as many as 80 million gallons of oily water have risen to the surface, and it's where a new flow broke out last week. In an email statement, Chevron acknowledges steam injection could reactivate the flow even more. The cleanup infrastructure at that site struck Tom France, an environmental advocate and almond farmer in Shafter. We catch up on the ground.
There were pumps on site. You could see them from the air. There were tankers there waiting to be filled with some of the crude that spilled out of the ground.
He also thinks he saw netting, meant to keep wildlife out.
So it was all very informative to see that from the air.
But his other major concern is transparency and accountability from state regulators, starting with information.
Spills like this have to be reported, and those are available publicly, but it's not easy to find these reports.
Dogger has slapped Chevron with a $2.7 million fine, but the agency also saw its lead administrator fired by Governor Gavin Newsom over conflicts of interest. Seven members of the Dogger staff were found to have invested in the oil companies they regulate. As for what France, Flores, and others want, it's not to shut down the entire oil industry, though they'd like to see steam injection scaled back until more questions are answered. For its part, Chevron says it's applying lessons learned from these incidents and doing all it can to prevent future ones. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. In most cities, people who live on the streets can at least find some relief staying for a night or two at a shelter. But a federal ranking shows Tulare and Kings as having the highest rate of unsheltered, chronically homeless individuals for counties of its kind in the nation. I went to Visalia in Tulare County, where one enterprising organization is hoping to serve these 300 or so people by modeling a Texas-based community. I'm going to start at a church dining hall in Visalia, where one afternoon a week, people line up to see if there are housing vouchers available through the Kings Tulare Homeless Alliance. And if that doesn't work out, well, at least they can count on clean clothes. That's one reason Ronald Martinez, who lives in his truck, is here.
Initially for laundry vouchers every Tuesday.
Laundry vouchers, he says. The 52-year-old says he's been homeless for about 6 months. He moved to the Valley a few years ago, but then his health took a turn for the worse.
I rented a room for 2.5 years, and I just had a heart attack. I had open heart, double bypass surgery, emphysema, asthma, diabetes.
And the list goes on and on. He lost his apartment after leaving the hospital and has been trying to get disability assistance and pick up odd jobs.
So anyway, needless to say, I right now I can't work.
Martinez tries to stay optimistic. He says others without a car have it worse, but he's frustrated that Visalia doesn't have enough affordable housing or more shelters. Michelle Smith, executive director for the Kings Tulare Homeless Alliance, says federal funding for homeless services across the two counties is about $2 million.
So trying to solve an issue with a very scarce amount of funds are just difficult, and we're stretching them as far as we can. In $2 million, we have 20 projects.
Right now, in Tulare and Kings counties, there are 7 emergency shelters, and only one has been supported in part by government money. Smith is also part of Tulare County's Homeless Task Force. The force includes representatives from city and county departments that interact regularly with homeless individuals, and they're developing a new strategic plan.
One of our focus areas or priority areas is to build permanent housing.
But she says it's not just about housing. Many who live on the streets experience a lot of trauma.
Unfortunately, that population on average spends about 10 years on the streets before they can get into housing.
They are the chronically homeless, the group of people one nonprofit called Salt and Light Works is targeting.
While we believe housing is critical to helping solve the crisis of homelessness, we actually believe that community is what actually solves or helps to really make a huge dent in the crisis of homelessness.
That's founder and CEO Adrienne Hillman. She's a Tulare native and former life coach. She's trying to build a tiny home community that provides permanent housing to the chronically homeless. The community she envisions will also have micro-enterprises and on-site health clinics.
And so it's that living in community that is different than it is than just living in the tiny homes.
The idea came to Hillman back in 2015. She wanted to support the county's homeless population. And through her research, she stumbled on the Community First Village in Austin, Texas.
When I went to Austin, that was the thing that struck me first, was the peaceful, clean, beautiful serenity that Community First Village is.
It's a big dream. Hillman wants to replicate the Community First Village as much as possible because she says it works. Community First's website says its retention rate is 87%. Like Community First in Texas, Salt and Light in Tulare would require tenants pay rent and would teach employable skills like cooking and baking.
I see a bakery and a cafe and a marketplace. I see a farm, an organic garden, a bus stop, and just opportunity.
But the community is still a ways off. Hillman says it likely won't be ready for people to move in until 2021. There's still site plans to be finalized and a lot of fundraising. Salt and Light Works is a nonprofit, and Hillman wants to pull this off with grants and private donations. She estimates it could cost around $5 million to get the community built and then $2 million to operate annually. She does, however, have a potential location for the 50-unit village.
Well, right now it's dirt, a beautiful piece of dirt.
She's asked that we not disclose the location at the moment, and here's why. She's already heard opposition to her project.
NIMBY, which is the acronym for Not in My Backyard, is a very, very real thing in the United States. And I think it's just, it's an organization based in fear and misunderstanding about what a project like this looks like.
But Hillman says she's not building a shelter or a tent community, and there are rules. Unlike other neighborhoods, there will be supportive services built in, like Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. Back at the church, Ronald Martinez says he would like to live in this type of community.
Either I sleep in the streets or do I sleep in a little room. And I would choose that room over the streets. When it's pouring down rain or it's freezing cold, you got thunder, you got lightning, or you got 120 degrees outside. Yes, I mean, I would say by all means.
Adrienne Hillman says if it were up to her, she'd be building it already. But she's trying to be realistic, something the name Salt and Light reminds her to do.
It is indicative of the work we're doing. Gritty, salty, hard, light, love, and good.
In the meantime, she's focusing on educating the community about her efforts. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. In early 2019, reporters from the Investigative Reporting Program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism obtained a list of criminal convictions from the past decade of nearly 12,000 current or former law enforcement officers and people who applied to be in law enforcement. State Attorney General Javier Becerra's office then sent a letter to the reporters telling them to destroy the list or face legal action. What happened instead was the formation of an unprecedented statewide media collaboration to investigate the list. I recently spoke with two reporters from the Investigative Reporting Program, Katie Roosh and Laurence Dassault, about their in-depth investigation and subsequent newspaper story on the McFarland Police Department. You may know the town for the Disney movie of the same name, about an underdog high school cross-country team that goes on to win a state championship. But McFarland is in the spotlight now for something far less inspiring, a reputation for hiring cops with criminal past. Katie, let's start with you. I want to know about the extensive amount of work it took to get these criminal records and to match them with current police departments. But before we do that, let's take a look at what you found. You write that one of every five officers who worked at the McFarland Police Department in the last decade, 16 in total, had been previously fired, sued for misconduct, or convicted of a crime. So tell us about some of these people.
Yeah, so this was a project that we started back in May and then really got started in June, so 5 to 6 months working on this project. And we really quickly uncovered that there were a significant number of officers within that department who had criminal convictions. And we did that through this larger project with the Investigative Reporting Program, which is where we work, where they were looking at officers with criminal convictions, and we noticed that many of them had come from McFarland. And from there, it was just heading to the courthouses and then confirming those convictions. And then beyond there, the reporting just really, you know, spiraled into a much bigger project, you know, from starting off with a few officers to many more. And just to mention a few of those officers, many of them are named within the article, but you have somebody like Ron Navarretta, who had been fired from the Inglewood Police Department in the early 2000s after he was caught up in an FBI child porn probe. And we talk about that pretty extensively within the piece. And then also, obviously, two of its most recent police chiefs, Greg Harrington and Scott Kimball. Scott Kimball still currently working as a police chief in the city of Arvin, and we were able to find a list of accusations against him from his time specifically when he worked as a Banning Police Department officer in Southern California.
And Laurence, let's talk about Greg Harrington for a minute. He says in the article, everybody makes mistakes. DUIs are nothing in law enforcement. And he's talking about people he's hired. And apparently he tapped into a pipeline of people from his old department, the Banning Police Department in Southern California. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, Gregory Harrington started his career in Georgia, and he was fired from Glynn County Police Department back there for a DUI while he says he was working. So with a patrol, not a patrol vehicle, but one of the county vehicles. And he, I think from there, this mentality of giving a second chance was a big part of him being a police chief in McFarland. And we spoke to a lot of people who worked under him, and they all said the same thing. They said, Gregory Harrington would give you a second chance. And they talked about that with a positive light, right? People deserve a second chance. And Gregory himself would Mr. Harrington would talk about his mentality of, you know, even police officers make a mistake and they have the right to have this second chance. And that's something we've been hearing about a lot. But there's a caveat. In some of these cases, one chance turns into two chances and three chances. And sometimes the result will be something as what we've seen in McFarland, where a lot of these people who have had many, many chances end up working in the same small police department. And it does have, what we've seen through or reporting in McFarland is that it does have repercussions in the community.
And these aren't small mistakes. These are DUIs and the one you mentioned about child pornography. And he took a lot of officers from the Banning Police Department where they had been fired, correct?
That is correct. So 8 police officers that had been fired from the Banning Police Department in Riverside were subsequently hired by McFarland. Some of them had criminal convictions. Some of them were fired for dishonesty. And what's interesting to see, too, is that some of these police chiefs knew about the guys that they were hiring, their troubled backgrounds, and still went on to hire them. And we've been told that this is a problem of lack of resources and you know, bad funding in these small police departments that have just trouble hiring police officers with clean backgrounds. But we found it really interesting to hear about police officers and police chiefs like Gregory Harrington talk about second chances and how police officers that have, you know, records of police misconduct and criminal convictions, you know, thinking about these men policing your streets is something that most people feel more or less comfortable with.
Well, the bar is low in McFarland, clearly, and it does seem like the excuse is that they're hiring the best they can. Does that hold any water, Katie?
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the most enlightening things that we found from this project was we really were asking ourselves that question when we started seeing all of these officers with troubled pasts. And we kept asking, how could they get hired? Who hired them? Did they know? Did they not know? And I think one of the interviews that was really, like I said, enlightening for me was with the first chief, David Fraser. He opened the department and he, you know, he's quoted in the article. He basically told me, you know, you should have looked at the backgrounds of the guys that I didn't hire, that this was his best option. And so he took a risk on people like Greg Harrington and Mike Weber. He took a chance on them because those were the best options that he had. And those were the people who were willing to take a job for $20 an hour in McFarland, California.
So what do you think of that?
We also decided to look at, you know, what actually was this allowed? Was this legal? Was this something that was sanctioned by the state of California or, you know, and we really looked at and trying to think if this was something that was allowed in the state of California. And what we found was, you know, and I think was surprising to me to find was that California is one of these states that has little oversight. Specifically, they can't take a license away from a police officer. In other states, they call it decertification. They can't decertify a police officer. So even if these police officers, you know, were found to be dishonest or they had a serious criminal conviction for a misdemeanor, then they were able to still get a job in law enforcement because their license would never be taken away. And so we really looked at that at the state level and saw that that was something that was really different than it is in most other states.
And I thought one of the interesting takes from the article is that even when these officers make arrests, their word doesn't hold up in court always because you've got these defense attorneys who can say, you know, here's a rogue cop. Do you trust him? And so the ripple effect is startling and affects the criminal justice system at all levels.
Right. And we talked to many people who said, yes, these officers' backgrounds did impact the way that we had to deal with their subsequent arrests. And it begs the question, how many issues did that raise for public defenders and district attorneys? And what was that like? And I think you have seen in the article that the majority of these officers no longer work at McFarland. There's one still actively patrolling, but most of the officers have moved on. I think that still, though, begs the question, what's happening in those other departments where they are still working in law enforcement?
So most of these cops have moved on to other departments?
Correct. All but 2 by our reporting have moved on to other departments. So the only remaining officers on the roster are Brian Wilson and Steven Nieves. And Steven Nieves is actually, by what we understand, not actively working for the department. He's been on military leave for the last 5 years. So he has been on the roster, but he's not actively working in the department.
And Laurence, what was it like reporting the story? I would imagine it would be uncomfortable to confront some of these cops, but I kind of got this sense from reading your article that they didn't take the criticisms too seriously.
I would say it really will depend on who we're talking to. What has been interesting about this reporting is that we were able to talk to every single police chief since 2009, which is the date that the department was reinstated in the city. And really talking to each of these men and hearing about their different perspectives on this was so interesting. And it's something that I think both Katie and I were very surprised that we were able to talk to these men in a very civilized manner usually. Gregory Harrington, David Oberhofer, Mr. Fraser, all of these men were really, you know, able to sit down with us and willing to explain to us what exactly happened in their mind and why they would hire these people. And it gave us a really good insight into the law enforcement community, really. And then some other interviews were much more confrontational and very hard. The interview that we had with current Arvin Police Chief Scott Kimball and former McFarland Police Chief Kimball was a little harder. And it was hard to entertain a conversation that went both ways because some of these guys would deny facts that we would find in documents. And it was hard for us to entertain a conversation that was not unilateral, that would go both ways. And so I would say it would really depend on the type of men that is sitting in front of you. And that's something that you can really only find out when you sit down next to these guys.
Well, you definitely did bring a side to the story that we haven't heard before. And Katie, let's talk a little bit more about how this project got started, because it sounds like it really gained momentum after the Attorney General threatened reporters with legal action.
That was our colleagues, Robert Lewis and Jason Palladino, at the Investigative Reporting Program. And so they initially received that list.
The list of cops statewide who had criminal past.
They're not all cops. It was 12,000 names of those who had either applied to be a cop, were a cop, or had been a cop and had a subsequent criminal conviction is what we were told that the list was. And so when we started, it was really just looking to confirm who actually did become a cop and who was still working as a cop with a criminal conviction. And so that's where we started. And Laurence and I had spent a good amount of time in Kern County, which is where McFarland is. And that's where we discovered this large concentration of officers who had worked in McFarland with criminal convictions.
And why was the Attorney General upset?
You know, that's something that I can't really answer because it wasn't something that I was intimately involved with. That was really something that, like, the project leads, Robert Lewis and Jason Palladino, were really instrumental in.
The interesting thing about this is that the fury of the Attorney General is really what sparked something bigger here, because we felt like, you know, asking this question of, is there something here that we're not telling us? And with the state of affairs in California right now, the secrecy surrounding police officer misconduct and police records is such that we started asking ourselves these questions. And that's when Katie and I really, really got involved, is after the Attorney General threatened with legal action.
And how many of these second chance departments are there statewide?
That is an excellent question that I wish I could answer. I would say the best answer I can give is it can happen anywhere. And it will depend on one person, and that is the police chief of that police department.
Yeah, so Laurence is absolutely right. And I think that's the big thing is that, you know, we have seen little pockets of what we believe could be other second chance departments just in our reporting. But I think Laurence is absolutely right that in the state of California, the sole discretion to hire a police officer, the sole discretion is up to the police chief in most cases. In some cases, the city administrator can have some exercise some authority, but most times it's the police chief. And if he decides, like a Greg Harrington, that you deserve a second chance because that DUI you got a few years ago, you really should be giving a second chance after that, he can decide that. And that's totally his prerogative.
And so who is the police chief now in McFarland?
The interim police chief, Janet Davis, who we've met and had extensive conversations with. Police Chief Janet Davis says she will never hire someone with a criminal conviction. She will never hire someone who has been fired for dishonesty or has had such serious misconduct in their past. That's something that she's been very adamant about. And looking at her current police department, it's something that I will tend to believe, because indeed, there is only one police officer from that list that remains currently on the force. But she did... She is conscious that she is currently the only thing stopping the department from re-becoming this second chance police department. She knows, she admits that there is no oversight from the state looking at police officer misconduct and trying to remove these police officers that commit repeated misconduct from the beat. She knows this is something that she can't stop by herself, and she knows that currently she is the only thing preventing McFarland from becoming the second chance police department again.
Wow, tough job. Well, we look forward to seeing what you produce next. Katie Roush and Laurence Dussault, thank you for being on Valley Edition.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. In 2013, the state implemented the local control funding formula, a new method of funding K through 12 schools. The goals were to give districts more flexibility in how they spend funds and to provide more resources for high-need students. However, a recent state audit, which included Clovis Unified, found that billions of dollars earmarked for high-need students are instead being used to support the general student population. FM 89's Kathleen Schock breaks down the audit with Clovis Unified legislative analyst Steve Ward and Fresno County Deputy Superintendent Dr. Catherine Catania. We also hear from EdSource Editor-at-Large John Fensterwald and Public Policy Institute of California Research Fellow Dr. Julian LaFortune.
All right, so before we talk about the findings of the state audit, I want to start by talking briefly about how local control funding formula works. So, John, if you could start us out, that would be great. You know, my understanding is that within this funding formula, school districts and charter schools receive what's called supplemental and concentration funds based on the number of high need students served. And that funding source comes on top of the base funding allocated to run the school. Now, this is a complicated formula, but it was designed to create a more equitable distribution of funding based upon the actual needs of students. Can you just briefly explain how all of this works? Because I think it's central to this conversation.
Well, what you said is exactly right. There is a base funding that all districts and charter schools receive. And on top of that, there's a supplemental and concentration, I'll explain the difference, that recognizes that some students need extra funding. And these are, in particular, low-income students, English learners, foster youth, and homeless youth. And for each student that you have in a district, you get additional money. It can be ranged 20% for every student. And then if you have lots of students, that's the concentration portion of it, your district gets even more. So, for example, Clovis, which has about, you know, a little bit more than 40% of these students, it gets around 8.5% additional money. But Fresno, next door, where it's close to 90% of students are low-income and English learners, and they get a little bit more than a third. So it does escalate as you get towards higher populations of these needy students.
Great. So, Steve, you're with us here in studio from Clovis Unified. Your district, along with Oakland and San Diego, were included in an audit that the state conducted, looking at how these monies were being used. And what the audit found is that really across the board, base funding was not enough to cover the basic needs of the district. And as a result, districts were using supplemental and concentration funds to cover those basic needs. Is that indeed what you have been experiencing at Clovis Unified? We'll start with that.
Okay. We primarily kept our supplemental concentration dollars within that allocation and did not move too much or very little over to the base. But the challenge is ongoing that the base dollars are not enough to cover the increasing cost of educating children in California. And there's been a lot of initiatives that have come along since the LCFF was implemented that is stressing school districts in how to cover those costs. The supplemental concentration is a great concept, and we've really used it to enhance the kids that need that extra help, especially at the social and emotional area, and we've used a lot of those dollars towards that end and seen great results from that. And the fact that we have the ability to work with our parents in a different manner than we ever did before and get their input from that perspective.
Dr. Catania, from your perspective as a Fresno County superintendent, can you tell us, is this an issue across the board? How have districts throughout Fresno County adopted to this new funding formula?
Well, it's been a beneficial formula across the county because it enables their local school board, along with the parents and their other stakeholders, to really determine what the most effective use of the dollars are and how to allocate those resources. But as Steve said, we know that across California, the base funding is really falling short of the basic needs of all students. And then also in the cases of districts that don't receive the concentration money, it limits their ability to do some additional services. If you look at the difference between Clovis and Oakland, for instance, they have about the same attendance, average daily attendance, Clovis 41,000 roughly, Oakland 34. But because 77% of the kids in Oakland are either English learners, foster youth, or socially economically disadvantaged students, Oakland gets another $31 million above what Fresno does, what Clovis does. So the formula needs to be looked at to really provide fair funding for all students across California.
Julianne LaFortune, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You've done a great deal of research with the Public Policy Institute of California looking at this funding formula. I'm curious, are you hearing similar things from other school districts? I guess that's the first part of my question. And then the second part of my question has more to do with another bit of criticism that came out in the report, which is that there is a lack of transparency about how these categorical and supplemental funds are being spent. In your research, was it difficult for you to find the data you needed?
Yeah, thank you. I guess just to the first point, that is something that I've been hearing, but it's difficult to tell exactly how, you know, money's being spent and whether it's going exactly where it needs to go. And that's in part a reflection of what, you know, and onto your second point, of what we found and what I've found in research, what the state auditor has found, and that it's difficult, at least comprehensively from a statewide perspective, to get a sense of how the money that we target under the local control funding formula, these supplemental and concentration dollars, are really reaching students. And that's because we target money based on districts. So we target money to the districts, and then we allow them, and we actually give them more freedom to determine how to best use this funding. And I think a lot of districts are trying, and they're facing very real cost pressures. But given that we've seen, you know, a lack of movement on achievement gaps over long term and this kind of sustained investment recently, I think this has led to a lot of questions over, well, you know, what is the money being spent on, and is it being spent in the way that benefits these students for whom it was intended the most?
And just as a point of clarity, what are the exact populations of students that this money was designated to support?
Yeah, so under the formula, the high-need students are designated as those that are low-income, foster youth, homeless, or English language learners. And so those are the students, and the form part of the formula is an acknowledgement that these populations may require additional resources to educate. And so we give additional funding to those districts that have higher shares of these students.
So, John, what are some of the potential impacts of this audit? much change can we see, potentially see in the future as a result of the findings?
Well, you mentioned at first that about the difficulties districts have in with base funding, that it's not sufficient enough. And the auditor recognizes that, but it's a very small portion of her audit. The point of the audit was to find out how districts were spending their supplemental and concentration money. And as Julian said, it was really difficult to do. And what the auditor said was, in general, we determined the state's approach has not ensured that funding is benefiting students as intended. And the focus here is not ensured. They just don't know. And so one of the reasons is that you're not districts are not required to, for example, they're not required to list how they spend the supplemental and concentration money as an auditor would. They're required to increase or improve services for the students for whom they were intended proportionately to the money. And that sounds wonky, but the difference is it's much harder to see in the document that the districts prepare how they spend the money. And I give Clovis, for example, credit. It's the only district that you could actually track supplemental concentration internally in its budget process. The other two districts didn't. But at the same time, the auditor said, we can't really tell the way that Clovis does its local control and accountability plan, which is the document that is the public document that's commented upon and built. We can't really tell how you're spending the money because you're kind of vague. You're supposed to say that this purpose is effective and that it's principally directed to these students, but we can't tell the way your document is constructed, and it's not Clovis alone, there are others. The other thing that the auditor pointed out was that money for concentration and supplemental that is left over at the end of the year can be used however the district wants. It could go right into the general fund, right into base funding. Now, districts can maybe justify that that's probably a good and maybe even intended to have that flexibility, but I think it's a perverse incentive, and that's one of the things that the auditor recommended that we eliminate, that supplemental and concentration money should be spent on the students, again, for whom it's intended.
So in the event, and I'm going to direct this question to you, Steve, in the event that the audit results in a change in the law that would prohibit districts from rolling over supplemental funds into base funding, what kind of impact would that have on Clovis Unified?
Well, I think, let me talk in general for school districts. And I think the challenge is that when the LCFF was implemented, these are some of the things that were discussed and asking for clarity on how those dollars, you had dollars left over at the end, there was no clarity in or direction of how school districts could or couldn't use those dollars. So a lot of districts are rolling that back into their base because of the need for the base funding of dollars. They have to cover the cost. They have no option. They're mandated costs, and they have to be covered. So if those dollars for districts that are doing that were siphoned all back into supplemental concentration, which is what was designed to be done, then the state is going to have to take a real hard look at, all right, now how do we address those needs for base funding dollars, which again, like I said, most of those are new dollars that are mandated that we have absolutely no choice that we have to spend. And like I said, it's increasing the cost of educating children in California, and we have to realize how are we going to pay those costs.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about a recent state audit that looked at the local control funding formula, which is how the state allocates money to K-12 education. So, Catherine, I'd like to direct the next question at you, and this is specifically about the audit. One of the things that came forward was what was described as a lack of oversight over spending by county offices of education. Can you explain what is the role of a county office of education in this funding process? And do you think that moving forward, your office may be called upon to be more involved with what districts are doing with their funding?
Well, when the local control accountability plan was set up, it was set up with very specific rules and guidelines that the county offices were to apply when reviewing the LCAPs of our local districts. And just as was stated a minute ago in the case, and like, you know, we're looking at Clovis's, they absolutely met that requirement where they stated where they're spending the funding. And so our office works with them, and Clovis does a good job of it, and we work with the other districts in Fresno County as well to make sure that they have enough detail in their LCAPs so that if they're using supplemental or concentration money, that they describe how it improves and increases services for those students. So I can't really speak to what else is happening around the state, but as the audit found in Fresno County, we were absolutely meeting the requirements that we were asked to do. Now, in the audit, it talks about wanting to put in more rules and guidelines about what should be in there. And so if that comes about, we will follow those rules and guidelines as they come about.
So I do want to talk more before we finish about what the future holds, but I'd like to, before we go there, just take a look at the current snapshot. Julian, you have been really leading efforts in the state to research how this funding formula is impacting districts. And I would love to have you talk a bit about what data shows about how higher need districts are spending under local control funding formula compared to what's considered a lower need district.
Yeah, so what we've seen, I guess, over the past 5 or 6 years with the improved situation economically in the state and with respect to the state budget, we've seen a lot of spending increases across the board in both higher need and, you know, more well-off districts. But what we see, and this is the direct result of the formula under the local control funding formula, is that we've seen a larger increase in spending in these higher need places and these higher need districts. And a lot of this money, it turns out, is going to student services and support staff, at least a lot of the additional money. And one thing that we don't tend to find, on average at least, is that there are relative increases or there are greater increases in spending on teachers in these higher need districts. And what turns out to be the case is that a lot of these higher need districts that are getting more money under the funding formula in the past few years are spending more to hire novice educators. So they're seeing smaller class sizes, they're seeing improvements in staffing numbers and ratios, so essentially more adults in the classroom, more adults in the school. But it's not translating into necessarily more spending, and that's because they're hiring more novice teachers, more novice educators that tend to be less experienced, and because of existing salary schedules, they're paid less. And when we look actually within districts, this is also the case. The highest need school or the most impoverished school within a district will tend to have smaller class sizes, but they'll also have less experienced teachers who are paid less. And so I think part of the key when we're thinking about, you know, what's the effect of this spending going to be and is it going to close achievement gaps, we have to think very seriously, not just, you know, are the dollars reaching these schools, but what are the dollars going towards? Are we hiring a lot of novice staff that don't necessarily stick around? And I think part of the ultimate efficacy of this reform and you know, improving the achievement gap going forward will be, can we retain and kind of hire these effective teachers in these types of high need places? And I think it remains to be seen whether we can do that, but the signs aren't necessarily encouraging in that regard.
Catherine, does that connect with what you're experiencing in Fresno County?
Well, as you know, statewide, there's a huge teacher shortage. So in Fresno County, we would love to hire experienced teachers for every classroom. Unfortunately, they're not out there. So part of, and you can see allocating resources is our hirings are the new teachers coming out of the teacher colleges and the different programs, because that's who's out there to hire. So consequently, we have to put amounts of money into professional development, coaching of these teachers, in-classroom coaching of the teachers. We're having the same thing with administrators. We have a lot of administrators retiring, so we have new administrators. These new administrators need coaching and help looking at how to run effective programs, how to collect data. And you look at, you know, in the case of like Clovis, when we were talking before about, you know, what's the effectiveness of the dollars, if you look at the California dashboard for Clovis, all of their math, English language arts, college and career, grad rate, are all in the blues and greens. So obviously they're doing a very effective job with the money that they've had, even though they don't get the extra millions of dollars for concentration funds. They have a really good teacher preparation program for new teachers coming in, but all districts are facing that we're having a teacher shortage and we're having to hire a lot of new teachers.
So we have to wrap up in just a couple minutes. John, I want to give you the last word. You are deeply involved in covering education throughout the state, and I'd love to have you weigh in on the politics of this. Local control funding formula was an initiative passed under Governor Jerry Brown. We obviously have a new governor in Sacramento now. I'm curious, what do you anticipate we might see around reform of this funding formula?
Governor Newsom hasn't weighed in yet as to the audit, but there's been a tension from the moment that the law was created between accountability for this extra money that we're giving districts for high-need students and the flexibility and local control that we're also giving them. And I read Julian's report. It was terrific, but he must be a contortionist because it was very hard for him to reach his conclusions because you can't track the money. So I think the bottom line of this audit is that the legislature is going to say, yeah, we agree with local control, but if we can't tell how this money is being spent for these students across districts because you can't compare them, we've got to come up with some way to do that and try not to reimpose controls that people recognize are not desired, but nonetheless be more transparent and accountable for how the money is spent.
Well, I thank you for being with us today. Thank you to all of our guests for talking about this. There's certainly going to be more discussion to come. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Monica Velez and Alice Daniel,
Laura Satsui and Carrie Klein. Technical support from Marv Ellen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.